history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told, and we're always better off for hearing them. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in a place I've never been before, Mankato, Minnesota, with 94-year-old Lee Nordgren, who grew up here and is still living here, father of five, grandfather to seven, and recipient of the Navy Cross, which is pretty unique in itself. But I want to go way back before that, Lee, who just celebrated his 94th birthday here in Mankato, by the way. Growing up here in Mankato, Minnesota, during the Great Depression and those years prior to World War II, what was that childhood like around here?
Well, I was quite fortunate in that my mother and father did have a better income than most of the people in our neighborhood. So I was spoiled that way. The interesting thing was that as I grew up, we moved into that home on North 5th Street when I was 2 years old. And until I was 10, the Catholic neighborhood kept saying every day, "Lee, you're not going to heaven because you're not Catholic." So I became interested in religion and had been brought up as a Lutheran, but it has expanded since then. I'm not a religious person. I am an honest person. I was in business for 49 years, and I can truly say I never once intentionally cheated a customer.
And that business was photography, which is something your father had experience with in World War I. And is it true that seeing a picture of him with flight goggles is what got you interested in aviation?
I think so. My dad had shown an interest in there. And then when I was probably around 10 or 12, I took a ride in a Ford trimotor with my grandfather on my mother's side, which fascinated me. And I thought, well, I want to learn how to do this. And so as I got older, got to be 16, I saved up money to fly when I could and reached the point of soloing before I was driving a car.
What was that first solo flight in? What kind of plane?
Well, that was a Cub. Yeah, it's a small airplane that actually has room for two. It has a stick in the front for each of the people who are there. And then you have your feet on rudders. You learn to coordinate. And it was such an early start for me that I was way ahead when I eventually went down to Mason City, Iowa to start my Navy career.
And there's something that happened before that I like to ask everybody about, because it seems like you all have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were or how you found out what had happened out at Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was a senior in high school then. I think I was at the YMCA down on 2nd Street, which doesn't exist anymore. Yeah, that made it a big adjustment. And I was fascinated by naval aviation. But at that time, you had to be a college graduate before you could fly for the Navy. And they changed that program over to call it the V5. And you had to be then simply 18 years of age, have good high school grades, and a very healthy body.
And so really not too long after Pearl Harbor, less than a year, you joined the Navy. How did your parents feel about that?
My parents they're both deceased now, obviously. They're patriots, and they believe that we should all help our country. That's a big plus. So when I said that I was going to join, at the same time, they were so good to me that I have a feeling they anticipated that I may not come home. For example, when I got my wings down in Pensacola in April of 44, I became an ensign. I was just 19 years old. But they drove down to Florida with Dr. and Mrs. Wentworth, looked around a little bit, and then left the car for me to use until I went to combat.
That says a lot right there. And I understand you learned something about your father's time in World War I that you'd never heard before. You'd grown up seeing this picture of him with a leather helmet and flight goggles, but you misinterpreted it?
Yeah, that was interesting. I always thought he had been a naval aviator then, and it turns out he was an aerial photographer. And when he came home from the Navy, career, he became a photo finisher and produced prints and film for drugstore dealers, 100 of them in southern Minnesota here, with a big operation.
Well, I can imagine that all of the people listening right now who, like you, are aviation fanatics, they probably want to know, well, if his dad was flying in World War I, what kind of aircraft was he flying in the teens, you know, before 1920?
Well, the planes that they flew were multi-engine, and the pilots sat way back from where the aerial photographer was. He was right up in front, so things didn't get in the way. They had to sensitize the film some way and then take the picture, bring it back down, and finish up the processing. Pretty primitive.
Very primitive, and flying was really not that safe in those days. And it still wasn't that safe when you started flying for the Navy. I bet there were some things in training that underscored that reality.
Well, over the time that I trained, there were a number of people who died in the training program. In fact, I think we lost more in training than we did in combat. This is as a carrier-based fighter pilot.
And when you say that, you lost more in training than in combat, I imagine if you're losing guys, at some point, they're people that you actually know, guys that you've actually trained with or gotten to know.
Yeah, that's true. There were several of them. Pilots in my class of 42 at Mankato High. One Smith disappeared from this carrier and was never seen again. They have no idea what happened to him.
So when things like that happen, do they make you wonder what's going to happen to you? What your ultimate fate in these high-powered machines up there in the sky going so fast is going to be?
Well, you have to use common sense and care. For example, when my brother died in 1955, the young man that brought him home, brought his body home for the funeral, was later killed in another accident, hitting the side of a hill or something. You just don't know what to expect, but you should be more careful than sometimes we are.
Yeah, and you allude to your brother, and this is a decade after World War II, but he had gotten into aviation following your example, and he died in a jet crash?
Yeah, in fact, they were doing a tail chase over one of the fields there in the San Diego area. And how it all came about is still a little fuzzy for me. So I can't really describe how it all came about, which is unfortunate because I'm sure John would like to have me know.
I wonder if there are any records we could find on that might shed a little light. And I imagine in some ways what you dealt with in World War II, if anything, can prepare you for dealing with that kind of loss. Maybe it's some of what you endured during the war. But let's go back to those training days. So you have this dream of flying. You're in the Navy now. You're in the program to become a fighter pilot. Was there a particular plane that you had your heart set on that you were hoping they'd let you get in the cockpit of?
Well, I never really knew that much about which aircraft was a top performer. When I went into the Navy, the F-4F Wildcat was the primary aircraft, and it was a dog. It was a terrible airplane. The Japanese were shooting them down left and right, which is one of the reasons they changed the regulations on getting more pilots. But then came along the F-6F Hellcat and the Corsair, and they both had a 2,000 horsepower engine. I flew the Hellcat during the war. It was a wonderful airplane. I flew the Corsair in reserve after the war, and it had a lot of flaws in there, and it really wasn't a good aircraft to be landing and taking off from a carrier.
How'd you feel about this idea of taking off and landing on a carrier? A little different than landing on those runways where you learned to fly here in Minnesota.
Well, first off, the Hellcat was such a wonderful airplane to fly. It was almost a treat every time I got in it. It was like having candy available all the time. In fact, after the war, my wife said, when I was in the reserve, she said, "Do they know they wouldn't have to pay you?"
Don't tell them.
Oh, it was a very stable airplane. And a lot of planes have characteristics that can get you into trouble without your being aware of you're getting into trouble. But the Hellcat was such a kind airplane. It would kind of remind you by its movements that you should get the nose down or add power before you get into trouble. That wasn't true with the Corsair. There'd be a lot of people alive today that are dead having flown the Corsair.
Well, and you made that comment before that you think there were more killed in training than in combat. So that makes me wonder about your experience in training. I'm sure you flew a lot of different planes as you progressed, the SNJ, the old Volte Vibrator, and all of those. Did you have some close calls? Were there some training flights that made you a little anxious or made you wonder?
Well, at Barron Field, that was the last field that we were at before we got our wings. The French sent a whole bunch of cadets over, and they totally ignored all the rules. So you had a quadrant that you had to be in. They ignored the rules about which quadrant you had to be in, and they just flying all over and running into each other. In fact, that's how we got the name Bloody Baron instead of just Baron. So we got a little hairy towards the end.
That doesn't sound that encouraging.
No, it wasn't encouraging. The SNJ, by the way, you had mentioned, very stable airplane and a good trainer. The Navy was very good about that. That was also called the AT-6, the Texan, I think. We're going back a long ways now, you know.
Many years, but I'm sure some of our listeners have either seen or been in those. They have some AT-6s going around that they give people rides in, and I think I've even put the landing gear down in one of those. So as you're going through all this time in training, you'd gone in 42, and time's going by, the war's changing. I'm sure you're hearing news come back, and maybe guys you knew were already over there. Were you a little antsy to get overseas?
Well, I felt that I had a moral obligation to participate after spending as much of their money training me and knowing that this Culpens that I flew off of was not a cheap operation, so I felt we ought to be doing something effective with it, which we ultimately did. Not for too long, though, because the war ended 3 months after I got into combat.
But in that very short time in combat, you actually came home with something that most Navy pilots never did, a Navy Cross. And I know that wasn't your goal. That's not what you were aiming for. But we've got to hear that story. Tell me about that carrier, though, the Culpens. Give people today maybe some perspective on the uniqueness of the situation back then as far as carriers go and what it was like for you to get aboard that floating city.
Well, the Culpens was actually made on a cruiser hull, and cruisers were designed a lot like destroyers. And if you've ever watched a destroyer go through the water, it was pitching and rolling all the time. They are not what you'd call a real stable ship. So here we have a dozen cruiser hulls that they've now converted to carriers. So each landing and takeoff that you experience is a new experience. It's either rolling, pitching, and going up and down. It was challenging. But I loved the Hellcat so much that it wasn't that dangerous for me to do. I just felt very comfortable with the aircraft.
And how many guys, how many other pilots were in your squadron? VF-50, was it?
VF-50, we had about 50 fighter pilots. And then we had some black shoes, that is, people who were helping us with the other duties than flying.
And what kind of connection or relationship or camaraderie did you have with those other flyers?
The people on the big carriers kind of poo-pooed us. They thought that the Culpens and the Independence, which was the other carrier that was in the task force of five, there were three big carriers, and those guys said, I'd rather land in the damn ocean than on your Culpens. So, yeah, it was interesting.
And I know a lot of people have heard about, you know, the Mighty Mo, because they've been on the battleship Missouri, and they know that that's the ship where the surrender was signed in September of 45. But maybe they haven't heard the nickname of your carrier, the Culpens.
The Culpens was actually named after a Revolutionary War experience. It was Mary's Culpen that was actually fought over and won by the revolutionaries, that is the people on George Washington's side. It was a battle of about 30 people, so it wasn't a big thing, but it was one of the rare ones that they won.
So the name, the USS Culpens, came from that Revolutionary War battle, but then they had a nickname for your ship, too. It wasn't the Mighty Mo.
Yeah, it was the Mighty Moo.
The Mighty Moo, yeah. For Culpens, yeah. Did you guys get some chuckles out of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it was a good era carrier, though.
And we'll hear more about the USS Culpens and specifically a mission that Lee Nordgren flew off of that carrier on July 25th, 1945. What he did to be awarded the Navy Cross. You can check out photos and video of Lee online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 94-year-old Lee Nordgren of Mankato, Minnesota. He just turned 94 on September 13th, and it's been an adventurous month for him. He recently was honored at Target Field in Minneapolis, where before every Minnesota Twins game, a veteran has the privilege of raising the American flag. We're about to hear why he was honored with the Navy Cross as a 20-year-old F-6F Hellcat pilot flying off the deck of that carrier he was telling us about, the USS Cowpens.
It was well-built. As I said, it wasn't really very stable, but if you paid attention to what you were doing, and something that you have to be aware of when you're making carrier landings, you're approaching at a relatively slow speed, above stall, of course, but the carrier itself is actually going up to potentially 35 knots. Then, too, the wind can be blowing, so the relative movement between you and the carrier can be relatively little.
Yeah, you talk about finding a moving target. I'm sure that was an acquired skill that you needed a lot of touch for. Well, after waiting so long to get out there into this action, and you said you felt a moral obligation to follow up on all the training you'd received, tell me about your first time, your first mission flying off the deck of the Cowpens.
Well, actually, the first mission that we experienced was at Wake Island. And the Japanese had taken Wake Island the day after they attacked Pearl Harbor. It was told to us that Japanese had a lot of practice, that everybody that went by there attacked them, so that we should be cautious. And tragically, the first loss that we had was an Ensign Pettypaw, who left a wife at home expecting a baby in 3 months, and which is why I had engagement and marriage rings for my wife, Donna, that I didn't give her until after the war, when we then officially got married.
I'm glad you brought that up. So that's an important chapter that I don't want to leave off. So we'll get back to the Cowpens. Tell me about Donna. How'd you meet her?
As a matter of fact, she was a high school junior when I was a senior. The newspaper for the high school was part of a program that we both got involved with in writing articles, and that's how I met her.
So you meet her in high school, then you go in the Navy, and you're still pretty sweet on her, and you're thinking this is the one?
Oh, yeah, I was sure. In fact, when I was at St. Mary's Preflight School out in California, I was very fortunate to stay in good, healthy condition, and I was, out of the 100 cadets in our particular unit, I had the first place in the obstacle course, which is shortest time. And that gave me the choice of the next base that I should fly on the Stearman, which was a biplane, open cockpit biplane. And there were 8 of them on the West Coast, the bases that I could pick, and there were 2 others. And I chose Hutchinson, Kansas. And everybody says, the wind blows there all the time, and it's a dry state. Well, didn't bother me about dry state. I didn't drink that anyway. But when I went to Hutchinson, then I got 4 days at the end, a day going home to Minnesota, visiting with my folks in Donna for 2 days, and then a day back before I then had to go to my next base.
Is that when you asked her if she would marry you?
No. Right now, I don't remember the specific day that I asked her to marry me. I know I was at the Topic Cafe with her when I asked her to go steady, and that was in the spring of 42. But I didn't want to get that deep into it because I thought, well, there's going to be some pretty girls that I'd like to dance with when I'm out and around, too, if we travel. And I didn't want to restrict her either.
But you mentioned you had the rings and everything. So everything was in order, but you two had a conversation about it to decide to wait to see if you made it home?
In fact, I had stored with Mrs. Engesser, who was the jeweler right next door. And in fact, when Donna found out that they were there and I hadn't offered them to her, she was a little irritated with me.
So how'd you leave it with her when you went overseas?
Well, the kiss and the hug and a goodbye. And she actually came out with my folks and my younger brother to San Diego to say goodbye. And it was very cordial. And I remember at the time that I said, "Come on, Dad, I'll buy you a drink." And my dad said, "You aren't old enough to buy a drink." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I think it works." And I took him down to the bar in the basement of the sophisticated hotel. And the gal at the door took a flashlight and shined it. She says, "Well, when you can take the piece of paper that says 2 on there and off, and it's legal, I'll be happy to let you in. But until then, goodbye." My dad laughed all the way up to the hotel room.
Well, you mentioned not being able old enough to buy a drink. I guess I didn't ask you how old you were when you flew your first mission.
Well, I had really thought about that, but again, I was a minor yet.
So your first mission was in 45?
In 45, yeah.
So you would have been 20.
Yeah, 21 is the age for acceptance on there. And that was at Wake Island. Then we went on from there. That's when we joined the 4 other carriers between Wake Island and the Philippines. Then we went on to Japan to attack almost anything that moved. If it sailed and I know I shot up a steam engine on a train, and it almost took me out when it blew up. And there are other things like that. Anything that looked perishable that we could make the Japanese uncomfortable with, we attacked. I never shot at people directly.
Well, you mentioned that shooting at a steam engine, and when it blew up, it almost took you out. I think I need to hear more of that story. So you're diving with other Hellcats and strafing things, and that's what you were strafing?
Yeah, you go to an area and you rendezvous and attack a certain territory together, and then you join up again and come back to the task force. If you tried to come back alone, you could easily get shot down by the people who are protecting the task force. So you have to be careful about that.
You mean your own guys?
Right. Yeah, because the Japanese, if they could get a Hellcat to run, they'd try to get in to attack there. We had kamikazes attacking all the time, but they were flying mostly ineffective airplanes.
But you're saying if they had a Hellcat that they found that they could get in the air, they would try to crash it into an American ship. So if you're coming back from a mission solo and they can't identify you, they're going to shoot you down.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, that was the hazard on the day that my flight leader and I attacked Curry Harbor on the 25th of July. And we were the only 2 out of the 200 that were in a cave in the clouds. The planes were milling around in there. No more than 2 airplanes together. It was so crowded. We lost our second section. A division has 4 planes in it. It's 2 sections.
Well, let's talk about that day, July 25th, 1945. It's only a couple weeks before the atomic bombs would really change the war and bring it to an end. You said 200 planes went out on that mission?
There were 200 airplanes inside this cavern in the sky. Part of them were to protect the task force. The others were to attack as they did the day before. Curry Harbor was like Pearl Harbor was to Americans. And it was well fortified and ready for any action that people would not want to get involved with. So when we broke out of the clouds after flying for about 45 minutes west into Japan, we saw the Issei battleship off to our right, and that was identified when I fired my 50 caliber machine gun for psychological reasons when I was attacking coming down, it recorded it on film. Because when we came back from Curry Harbor after attacking, people said, "Where the hell have you been for the last hour and a half?" And we said, "We were at Curry Harbor," and they all said, "Bull," until the next day when they saw my film.
All right. So I just want everybody to understand the big picture and the context here. You said Curry Harbor is like Pearl Harbor, and what you meant by that is there's a large concentration of Japanese forces, and it's very well defended. So if you are going to go attack that, you'd probably want to have strength in numbers.
Yeah, you spread out the people firing at you. In fact, after I dropped my bomb on the Issei, I stayed low to the water, figuring that if they aim at me that low, they're going to have to go across the bay and shoot at each other, too, while they're firing. But my flight leader got up there where he should have been shot down right away. And for no reason at all, he got away with it.
Well, and I'm sorry for bouncing around with you, but I don't want to leave out some important details. One of the reasons you were decorated with the Navy Cross for this mission, for this incident, is that you kind of weren't supposed to be there, and nobody else was. It was just two planes out of the 200?
The irony of that is that we had specific orders to jettison our ordnance that was proper to get rid of before you came back to your carrier, because they don't want bombs and rockets flying down the deck on a carrier.
And that was because the weather was bad? They told you to abort and come back and jettison your ordnance?
Yeah, the weather was bad so that they couldn't get out of that stormy cage. There's just no way. And yet my flight leader chose to do that. He wasn't a very good instrument pilot, but I stayed on his wing, and fortunately we got to Curry Harbor and back.
So the rest of those 200 planes obeyed the order and returned, but your flight leader, Dotson, decided we're going to go after some ships?
Yeah, he said, "I want to, on a separate channel," he said, "I want to hit a target of opportunity at least." We went west and didn't break out at all until we came to Curry Harbor.
And I realize you don't have a whole lot of time to think about it when you're up there in the sky in your Hellcat and your flight leader has made that call. Was there a moment where you said, "Should I go back or should I follow?" And how'd you make that decision?
Well, when you're a wingman, your responsibility is to your flight leader. And so I had no problem with that. I figured that if he's made a mistake, I'm just sharing the mistake with him. The interesting thing was, after we came back from the attack, our PR people discussed what should be done with it, and they decided that some metal just beyond the air metal, which isn't very high, we should be put in for. And lo and behold, it came back with the Navy Cross. So I think they were being more kind than they should have. We should have been dead.
Well, yeah. So I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You're a 20-year-old kid from Minnesota who's out here in the Pacific flying in this horrible weather. Your flight leader decides to ignore a command, go on with the mission and try to do some damage. And you don't want to let him down as his wingman, but as you started following him toward who knows what, did you think, "I don't know if I'm going to get back to the ship at all. This may be it for me"?
Well, one of the problems, too, is that I didn't have the equipment operating that permitted me to come back to the carrier task force and know what was the proper area to approach the task force from, so that I could be in jeopardy for being shot down by my own airplanes. YEZB, I think, is what they called it. The YEZB. If it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you had to come in from 50 degrees. And at another time of the day, you came in at a different angle to the task force. And while it was all general, it still gave them a chance to decide whether they wanted to shoot you down or not.
And a second ago, you made a very blunt and direct statement. You said we should have been dead. Help us understand why that's the case.
Well, when you have a whole bunch of people that are angry at you and they all have guns and they're all shooting at you, the chances are that someone is going to hit you. And the fact is that neither one of us got hit. And that's why they didn't believe us when they checked our airplanes and our airplanes were clean. But when they saw my gun film, they knew that we had been there.
So, and I'm sure this is a a day, that July 25th of 45, that you've thought about quite a bit since then and probably replayed in your mind a few times. But if you can, take us from the start to the finish of that attacking run that you and Dodson made on those Japanese forces.
Well, as we broke out of the clouds, I pulled my plotting board out and looked, and I said, we're at Curry Harbor, and that's the EC battleship over there. He said, right, we'll spread out and attack. You take the port side, and I'll take the starboard side. And that's what we did. And I can remember going down, diving down on the carrier, is that when I fired the machine guns, which is not going to do a whole lot to a battleship, it would make some noise, but it also recorded what we did. But it also then pulled my shoulder straps down. And here I'm at probably diving at 60 degrees, and it actually slowed the airplane down. There's 650 caliber machine guns in the wings. It slowed me down.
Just the force of them firing?
Just the force of them firing.
So you're firing on your way down, and there's probably some other stuff coming back up at you.
Yeah. Oh, I said partway down, I said, Dodson, they're shooting at you. And he said, hell, look behind you. I didn't. I didn't have an interest in knowing what was back there. It wouldn't help anything anyway.
What's your guess?
Well, if it was like it was behind him, it would be a mess.
Anti-aircraft fire exploding behind you?
Yeah, just anti-aircraft were firing. There were no Japanese planes in the air at that time. None.
Probably a good thing.
Well, yeah, if there had been some fighters there, we'd have had some additional problems. Then they'd have to cut off firing at us in order for the planes to attack us, too. So it gets complicated for them, too.
So you make that dive on this battleship, and then you drop a bomb or no?
Yeah, we each we just had 500-pound bombs, but we dropped our bombs on the ship, and we had hydrostatic fuses, which means that they go down into the water a few feet to get below the protection area, and then they explode, so they're a lot more effective that way.
So you dive on the battleship, and then you pull up, and then what?
Well, I didn't pull up. I stayed right down on the water. I thought that if they wanted to shoot at me, they'd also be shooting at each other, people on the ground. But my flight leader pulled up where he really was a prime target and should have been shot. But I caught up with him just before he got back into the clouds. Otherwise, I'd have had the problem of getting back to the task force without getting shot down by our own people.
So what was the result as far as damage inflicted?
I'm not exactly sure. The battleship, the EC, was moored there, so we weren't sure. Supposedly somebody had said it's a foot lower in the water, but I don't know whether that was blarney or not.
So you have to catch up to him to make it safely back to your ship, and then you guys do make it back to the cow pens, and the reaction was?
Well, like I said, was using profanity, then I won't do it again. They didn't believe us until they saw my gun camera film. And that verified the EC battleship, which was the only one that was left. Only EC-style battleship.
What was it like for you to see that gun camera film?
Well, it wasn't a surprise because I had fired it, and gun camera film had been working for me on other targets, so it just confirmed it. But it was in the ready room. They ran it for the other pilots to see, too.
And I wish we could watch that film now. I don't have that, but you will find photos and a short video of Lee Nordgren at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And I'll read his Navy Cross citation for you when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 94-year-old Lee Nordgren of Mankato, Minnesota. He spent 3 years on active duty as a Navy fighter pilot during World War II. Another 27 years in the reserves, retiring with the rank of commander. You heard him say, "We should have been dead," when describing what he and another pilot did on July 25, 1945, disobeying orders to return to the USS Cowpens and instead pushing through bad weather to attack an Issei-class battleship-slash-carrier in Kure Harbor. That ship would be finished off by other planes a few days later, and I do have a photo of the battleship for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also read Lee's Navy Cross citation signed by Secretary of the Navy John L. Sullivan. For extraordinary heroism as pilot of a fighter plane in Fighting Squadron 50 attached to the USS Cowpens in action against enemy Japanese forces in the Inland Sea of Japan on July 25, 1945, after all other planes of the task force returned to base because of extremely adverse weather conditions, Lieutenant Junior Grade, then Ensign Nordgren, accompanied his section leader through to the target area, then executing a bombing and strafing attack on a battleship slash carrier. In the face of accurate anti-aircraft fire, he inflicted serious damage on the hostile vessel. His gallant fighting spirit and unwavering devotion to duty were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. What did that mean to you to get the Navy Cross, really in order of prominence, second only to the Medal of Honor, to get the Navy Cross and have those words said about you, a 20-year-old kid from Minnesota? What did that mean to you?
Well, it certainly it made a big thing for the Mankato Free Press, because when I came home, all the different service clubs wanted me to talk about my experience. The circumstances were such that I'm pleased that I could be of service after they're spending the money to train me to do it.
In all the years since then, have you ever thought back on that day and wondered, what was I thinking?
No, not really, because that was my job, just to stay with my flight leader, help protect him against other attack, and maybe even find our way back again if it was necessary, because flight leaders can get confused too.
You mentioned speaking at service clubs when you came home from the war, and one of those was the Mankato Kiwanis Club?
Yeah, in fact, I just spoke a couple weeks ago to the Mankato Kiwanis Club and said, I asked if there'd anybody that had heard the first talk. And obviously, 72 years later, they weren't there. In fact, I'm the oldest member of Kiwanis. I was asked by Cease Jones to join in 1950. Really, really am proud of having been a Kiwanian for that long.
And I'm, you know, as I hear that story, I'm wondering, you may be the only one. I wonder if there's anybody else in the country who has spoken to the same service club on two separate occasions 72 years apart. Because they don't have too many speakers in their 20s usually, right?
No, that's right. In fact, 2 weeks ago when I spoke at Monday noon, I purposely put out $20 and put it in the kitty and said, now, I don't think any speaker that I've experienced has ever put money out to speak to Kiwanis. And here's $20. So if you get nothing else but that from my talk, you got $20.
I'm sure they got a whole lot, but I don't know if they got another story of yours from the end of the war, because as you mentioned, you got into combat just months before the war ended, but you did have significant action, obviously, with the Navy Cross. And then you got a taste up close and personal of what some of the American prisoners of war had dealt with. How did that unfold? How did you come to see and witness some of those conditions?
Well, we were sent up from Yokosuka Naval Air Station to precede Governor, or now Commander Stassen, to organize and put the 2,000 prisoners of war on a train to come back to Tokyo. They weren't sure whether the people up there knew the war was over or not, so they sent a couple of ensigns up. So I came up there with my wingman. And by the way, Honshu, that's the main island with Tokyo on it, is about the size of Minnesota. And flew up to Honshu, and I landed there. And, of course, I don't know any Japanese, and the people there don't know in English, but I took some four-pack cigarettes along. I don't smoke. I've never smoked, but I took them along for conversation. When I put them out, and here's a Japanese fellow, said, "Ah, Chesterfield." So I signaled to have him come over for me, and I'm on the wing of my plane because I had told my wingman to stay in the air until I took my helmet off in case they needed some reminder with firing at a wall or something. Anyway.
Because you weren't sure they knew the war was over?
That's right. If they decided, well, what happened then is that he took off running when I signaled I wanted to go with the Americans in a ride there. And he came back with an officer with a long, long sword and about eight men with rifles. When he took his sword out, I thought, well, if I try and get my pistol out from behind my life preserver, I'll have four or five holes in me before I can get it out anyway. So I might as well just jump down. And I jumped down, and then he offered me the sword as a piece. And I was stunned, but I accepted it from him. And then after a few moments, I gave it back to him, and the people all cheered. That's when we got the ride from the airport, a grass field, by the way, to the prisoner of war camp. And we got to the prisoner of war camp. There were about 2,000 of them there. We were asked to speak to the group. They put a table out in the middle. And the first question they asked me was, "What's going on with baseball?" "I don't know a bleeping thing about baseball." So Bill Sutherland, my wingman, spoke to him about that. But it almost brought tears to my eyes just looking out at those people. And some of them had been captured in the Philippines and were still alive. My second night there, first night I slept in the cockpit, second night I slept because I had a throat infection. I saw more bugs than I'd ever seen in my life. And I thought, wow, just these guys have lived in this for days, weeks, and months, and years. I was very happy then when the doctor said, "Well, you really shouldn't fly, but if you're going to fly, you better get out there and go." So I flew back down to Yokosuka, and they took me out to the ship. And that's when it was reported that I had received the Navy Cross and had points to go home. Nobody on the ship but my flight leader and a chief petty officer were qualified to go. I mean, it hadn't been that long, 3 months there. But they put me on the USS General Sturgis, and I'd been playing bridge in the ready room waiting for combat deals when got to the point where I thought I was doing fairly well at bridge, except I sat down with the people on the General Sturgis, and I should really have been a lot more aware that I was dealing with three Army people and one Navy man, because the $200 that I had went real fast.
Lesson learned. You're on your way home, and you're probably thinking, well, what's Donna up to, and how long should I wait to marry that girl?
Actually, there was so much puke being thrown up all over that ship, it was such a smelly thing that I didn't really have a thought on what I was going to do after I got home, other than the hope that I could make it home.
Let's go ahead and backtrack a little, too. You told it very quickly and very matter-of-factly, but that scene of you landing and encountering the Japanese, and they come out with a sword and rifles, and you think they're going to kill you when they want to hand you the sword and say, "Yes, we surrender, we know what's going on." What were those few moments like for you when you dropped to the ground and then realized, no, this is the opposite of what I thought it was?
Well, obviously, the transition was a difficult one, and it was a very momentary, because from the time that he had the sword in his hand to the time that he offered it to me was pretty short. It was an unsteadying thing. But I thought, well, I can't smile, but I at least am not going to cry.
But then when you saw those prisoners of war, you probably felt like crying. Can you describe for us the kind of condition that they were in?
Oh, they were so emaciated looking. It's hard to believe. One of the problems that we had, too, is that we were destroying the supplies that were coming in from overseas for the Japanese. And that was the food that was going to feed the Japanese people and the prisoners of war. And you can hardly blame them for wanting to feed the Japanese before they fed the prisoners of war. And that's what it was. They did keep them alive, but it was tragic, really tragic.
Powerful perspective to pick up as a 20-year-old kid. So they give you the Navy Cross. That gives you enough points to come home now as opposed to waiting. How long did you wait to get married?
We were married in June 1946. As a matter of fact, the day that Donna was getting ready for the wedding, that day, my mother said, "Donna, I'm expecting a baby." So I have a sister, Jane, who was 20 years younger than I am. My mother was 45. Donna and I were married for 70 years. She died December 29th, 2016. She was a terrific leader. That sounds funny, but she had good judgment. I'm not a fussy eater. I'm not fussy about a lot of other things, too. So when she made the decisions, it was rare that I had to disagree and have a difficult time. So it went off pretty well.
Well, you've shared a lot of what you went through. I'm sure there are a lot of stories we didn't hear, but there's one thing I don't want to forget to say, and that's thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a little bit about it. When you think back on it, when you think back of that 20-year-old kid in the cockpit of that Hellcat, what are you most proud of, and what are you most thankful for?
Well, it may be peculiar, but I did have a knack for that particular aircraft, and I had a reputation for being able to handle it quite well. So after the war, when we were in Bemidji on 2 weeks active duty, the guys came back from drinking with the Air Force people who were in Bemidji flying P-51s, flying along the Canadian border, waiting for Russian bombers. That sounds weird, but that's what they were doing. And they'd come down and come roaring across the field at real low levels and look just like fighters. We always came and practiced like we were going to make a carrier landing. Wheels and flaps down, propping low pitch, and like a bunch of old ladies, or old men maybe. We don't need women picking on me. So they came and said, "Lee, we got a deal for you. Tomorrow morning, Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, you're going to take on two P-51s in a dogfight at 2,000 feet. And I said, "That's illegal." And they said, "Nah, nobody up here cares." And I thought, well, they figure I'm going to get beat anyway. So, and I beat them, which is, everybody was stunned, because for months after that, at the bar at the Naval Air Station, you'd see guys pointing their finger at me. They were pointing, say, "That's the guy that beat the P-51s.
So it was you alone and one Hellcat against two P-51 Mustangs?
Yeah, but one-on-one.
Oh, you took them on one at a time?
Yeah, one at a time. And I don't know how much background they had. The airplane that I had was kind of beat to hell, but so might have been the ones that they were flying. And so I have no knowledge, other than they got chided for getting beat. And with me, when we landed and reported back, the lieutenant commander that was in charge there said, "Nordgren, you're going back to Minneapolis today, and you're going to lose your wings and your commission." And the chief petty officer that was standing there went over and told the enlisted man who'd been watching the fight. He came back and said, "Commander, if Mr. Nordgren goes back today, the enlisted men are all going too. It's the first chance they've had to be proud of the Navy since they've been here."
Now, there's a story I've never heard before. Well, let's finish with this. Since most of us alive today weren't alive during World War II, we didn't deal with losing buddies, losing friends. Later, you would lose your brother. What do the rest of us need to understand about what you all did and why you did it?
Well, we trusted our leadership to make the better judgment. And very frankly, I am nervous today, not seeming to be concerned about whether we're going to get into World War III or not. It really is unfortunate.
What do you think we can learn from what America was like 70 years ago?
Well, I think that the human nature is similar now. I suspect that the young men today are more oriented around taking care of their country than they probably are in other countries, too. I think we have good patriots here.
And we've been listening to one of them for the last hour. That's Lee Nordgren, 94 years old, of Mankato, Minnesota. Take a look at what he looked like as a 20-year-old Navy pilot and what he looks like now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.